Welcome to Unbridled Aloud, a series of conversations with writers laced with a little bit of reading, sponsored by Unbridled Books. I'm Kay Callison. On this edition, we're talking with Tara Yellen about her debut novel, After Hours at the Almost Home. Tara Yellen took the MFA in fiction writing at the University of Virginia. After Hours at the Almost Home is set in Denver, where she took her master's degree in English from the University of Colorado at Boulder. It's Super Bowl Sunday, the busiest day of the year, when JJ, a recent college graduate who's never waited tables before in her life, shows up for work at the Almost Home Bar and Grill, probably on the wrong day, and Marna, the head bartender, has shown up for her shift, but then just disappeared, leaving the rest of the crew to deal with it, which they do, clear into the after hours when they stick around with three of the so-called regulars to drink on the QT for free, because the Almost Home operates with an absentee manager, leaving Keith, who won a Wait Person of the Year award a couple of years back, to close out the books for the day. They're joined by 14-year-old Lily, the very precocious and very troubled daughter of Colleen, one of the waitresses. Here she is, with Denny the bartender.
Lily kept a running tally of all the guys who wanted to fuck her. The latest version went like this. Randall Dean, Lance, the bagger at Save-A-Lot, Mr. Davis, Rochelle's two brat brothers, Brent and Tyler, and possibly their father, the bus driver, Denny. Denny had only recently been at it, and Lily wondered why she hadn't noticed before. He looked up at her now as she sat down on a stool, gave a little smile, came over. He was wearing his black Neil Young concert t-shirt, the words in it worn into dashes and polka dots. "Hey there, El Pad," he said. "Good to see ya. Right back at ya." She licked her upper lip. "You stick around just to see me?" "Sure thing." "Yeah, right. Who do you like more, me or Marna?" "Always you." "Who do you like more?" Lily asked silently. "Me or Lena?" "Bitch, hag, makeup whore," she said. "So Marna took off." "Yup." "She's not coming back." "Dunno." "She's not, I can tell. It sucks." She sighed. "I guess she divorced us all, huh?" She looked away, then smiled. "Not that I'm not happy to see you, of course, Denny." "Of course." She leaned in. "How about a drink? My mom's downstairs. How about some ID, Lily?" He scooped ice into a pint glass and filled it with Sprite, then popped in a straw and plunked it down in front of her. "Very funny." "A drink," he said, "is a good idea." There was such a difference, thought Lily, with older men. She watched Denny stretch down to pull a bottle of beer from the cooler, then click off the top of the opener and slug back a gulp. Maybe he'd talk, and maybe he wouldn't. Nothing like the guys, the kids, Lily knew from school. Denny was an interesting development. "How's school?" he asked. He was wiping down the bar, making circles with a dish rag. "How's work?" she shot back. "Right, right," he said. "Good point." "I can't talk about school without a drink." "You do have a drink." "Come on, Denny." She watched him pull back the last of his beer and toss it into the bin. "You're teasing me," she huffed and spun around on her stool. He had a girlfriend, Stephanie, but from what Lily had gathered, it wasn't a very good relationship. "One," he said, and glanced over to where Lena and Fran were squawking it up. "Just one." And like Lily knew he would, he got a mug so no one would see and poured a shot. It was green, watermelon liqueur. "That stuff," she complained, "not even 40 proof. I might as well breathe cough syrup vapors." She took it, though. She liked the taste of liqueurs, and if she wanted to, she could always sneak back later, when they were all at the corner table drunk and blathering, and free sample some Goldschlager. Now that was good stuff. 80 proof and with real flakes of gold, which Lily picked off her tongue and saved in napkins. At home, she had a thimble almost half full of gold. She was going to melt it down when she had enough, maybe even make some earrings or turn it in for cash. "Now don't tell your mother," Denny said, which is what he always said. "Don't tell your mother." The words echoed wickedly now. Denny pulling down her pants, Denny licking her belly, Denny. Lily stuck the tip of her tongue into the drink, then rubbed it on the roof of her mouth, watched him wring the bar rag, suds up the sink. Older men and younger women. It was the oldest story in the book. Humbert Humbert wasn't done in by some middle-aged biddy. "So tell me," Denny broke in. "Tell you what? About school, kiddo, wasn't that the deal?" "Oh," she said. ate the history quiz without studying, read 3 library books, lost 2 textbooks, fucked 1 shop teacher. What? Oh, it's nothing. That sort of thing happens all the time, you know. She watched Denny's face. It was hard to tell with him how something registered. She rounded her shoulders a little, leaned her elbows on the bar to give him a hint of cleavage. Last year, Mr. Apopoulos left his wife for a student he'd been screwing since she was in his 9th grade history class, which, if you ask me, wasn't so stupid if you saw his wife. How terrible, Denny said, but he cracked a smile, proof he was onto her. No, see, it's not really, and besides, girls aren't so young when they're, you know, young these days. I guess that's true. Oh, it's absolutely true. She paused, drank half a shot. Yum. Hey, can I bum a smoke?
Tara Yellen, reading from her debut novel, After Hours at the Almost Home. Tara Yellen, I would gather from reading After Hours at the Almost Home that you've done your share of waitressing. Is that true?
That is true. I started out waiting tables when I first turned 21 and I was finishing up college. And it was a way for me to be social and make some money at the same time. And I just kept doing it all through grad school and in between college and grad school while I was freelancing.
Well, I confess that I did the same thing all through graduate school, so I could really identify with a lot of this novel. In fact, most of it. How did After Hours at the Almost Home start for you?
Well, I really wrote it in one weekend and then revised it over a number of years. I was in Colorado finishing up my master's thesis, and I was doing a collection of short stories, and then about a month before my thesis was due, I was working at 2 bars in Denver, and one of them was a martini bar, and the other was kind of a neighborhood sports bar. And somebody there just didn't show up, and the next weekend it just sort of sparked something for me, and I liked this idea of what happens when somebody takes off in kind of a close-knit but transient community. Something about the restaurant business in general, it's very transient. I've had jobs that I kept for 2 weeks, or people may stay for their whole lives, but there's always sort of a group that comes in and out, and yet during any night, especially a busy night, everybody kind of has to come together as one. So there's this intimacy that's created, and I was sort of interested in what happened when somebody just decided to leave and take off, and a friend of mine described it a little like when Marna takes off, she peels a layer of skin kind of off of it. It sounds a little disturbing, but if you can get past that, she kind of leaves everybody else exposed, sort of more aware of whether or not they're stuck.
Can we talk about the structure of the novel, the fact that it takes place all in one night and yet you learn all the backstories about the people? Was that part of the original draft that you wrote?
It was. That's actually something that's pretty much exactly the same. I'm really interested in time and how it has the illusion of being linear in my mind. And I think that the way that I wrote this book, the fact that it takes place in one night and yet doesn't feel constrained really to just this flash of moment, there's a lot more that we get through the backstory, kind of talks to that nonlinear feel of time.
Do you see any one character in this ensemble as being in any way the point of view character at all?
That's a great question. At different points, I sort of felt different things. JJ's sort of the opening voice and brings us in, and Lily certainly kind of steals the book in some ways. I think if I had to choose a main character, I'd say the bar itself. I think in some ways it's the bar that's the main character.
I was curious, too, about the way the sections of the novel are titled. Did you do that yourself, or was that an editorial decision, such as the first one being These Frogs Don't Get Lonely?
That was my choice. I did that.
It struck me after a couple of readings that These Frogs Don't Get Lonely, JJ is worried about her frog, Norman, at home, who is in one of these cube aquariums. And you just put one pellet through this little hole in the top, and that's supposed to keep them entirely happy. And the bar itself, the way it's described from the outside, it's a cube, too.
It sounds great. I love it. But no, I think it's exactly what I was after. I don't sometimes I see things afterwards. It seems like I must have had it in mind beforehand or planned it, arranged it. But all of these things just happen as story, and these people come up as real people, and these quotes sort of come out to me, and Norman the Frog. They just kind of, as I write, it seems like I'm uncovering them, and they already exist. So I don't really plan this stuff, but I like that it works.
And there's kind of an irony, too, because, in fact, one way you could describe most of these people is that they're all pretty lonely. They're kind of all lost in their own backstory, are they
definitely.
Not?
Definitely, yeah. I would definitely say that was true.
Where did you get these characters? Were they at all based on people you'd actually waited tables with or types you'd observed or anything like that?
Yes and no. I mean, I waited tables and bartended for over a decade. And yes, I think there were bits and pieces. There's no character in here that comes directly from real life, but there are certainly bits and pieces of real people all over the place. It gets me in trouble at times. To me, it's really more about playing around with the fact to get to kind of a more truthful truth, if that makes any
mm-hmm.
sense. I think that there's an emotional reality where there may not always be factual reality, or I hope so.
Well, your psychological insight is extraordinary. I was interested in the mother-daughter relationship between Colleen and Lily.
Well, Lily, right after saying there are no main characters, Lily certainly is central to this book, and she doesn't come in until later in the book, about a third of the way through. But she's essentially parentless at this time. I mean, her father's died, and as you say, Colleen is worse than absent. I mean, she's there, she has her daughter at the bar late at night, or watched by this cousin or that cousin, and even worse, she's not sober. I think also very much when something for Lily is that all of the adults kind of let her down here, and her mother in particular, because she needs so much, and she needs so much from Lily. Lily is never able to get what she needs.
Do you think that Colleen's going to get it together at some point after the novel ends?
I do not think that Colleen will get it together. I think that the hope in this book is carried by Lily, and I hope that she has hope, because I would like that very much.
Not too long after the death of the husband and father, Colleen left a secure job as a respiratory therapist and went to work at the bar where they had always hung out together and taken Lily since she was a little girl. Why do you suppose she did that?
I think that she needed to stay with Rick. I think that on some level she wasn't able to process or wasn't willing to process this change. And this is one way that she was sort of able to hold on to things. I also wonder how stable things were with Rick, and suspect that Colleen needs a little bit of instability in her life to feel comfortable.
Also, it's the irony. The almost home had been almost home to Colleen.
I think that is definitely true. I think that for a lot of these characters, they feel almost home.
And the other thing is that you've got a parentless child and a mother just totally adrift. But that's paralleled, isn't it, by what you learn about the other people there, too? Don't they all kind of share that in common, a lack of sense of ties to roots and home and other kinds of attachments?
Absolutely. And I think that, again, with Marna leaving, the bartender taking off, it only makes them more aware of that.
Did you find that to be true among people that you worked with?
Yeah, definitely. I've worked in all over the country in all different sorts of restaurants, and whether it was an upscale fine dining restaurant or if it was a saloon in rural Indiana, there was an eclectic group of people, and you couldn't pin it down to any location. And in every case, it did seem that I met a lot of, whether they were writers or artists, or whether they moved around a lot because they were running away from something, or they were hoping to make it big in some other way. Usually people working in restaurants, or I should say often people working in restaurants, have some other line of work or some other dreams. And everybody kind of comes in with all of their different problems and different worlds, and everything collides.
Which is what we see in the novel, a very dramatization of people not being able to keep the outside outside. They bring it in with them.
That's right, yes.
The question of Marna, that is an interesting question. In literature, you've got the absent character who is, in fact, in some ways, the most present person in the novel.
Right. Maybe Marna's the main character. We begin with her disappearance. I like that. I hope that she is sort of there and at the center, kind of quite making them reevaluate each of their own places.
Well, she's sort of the exotic one, right?
She is. We get her from different points of view, so I'm not sure how close that is to the real Marna, but she does take on kind of a mythical entity.
One thinks of a title that's sort of become a stock phrase in our language, like Waiting for Godot. It's like looking for Marna.
Yeah, I think they are all sort of looking for Marna on some level. They definitely are.
I think they kind of envy Marna.
Absolutely, the one who is able to take off, to leave. Or even worse, in her case, she showed up and then just taking off.
Terry Yellen talking about her debut novel, After Hours at the Almost Home. I'm Kay Callison. Here's another scene. It's late at night. The Almost Home is closed, and some of the crew and two of the regulars, one of them is Fran, who used to work there and now just drinks there, are playing a drinking game at one of the tables. Lena and Colleen decide they're hungry and go into the kitchen to fix some food.
Lena and Colleen went back into the kitchen and fried up some poppers and chicken fingers. Unless she was doing the cooking herself, Lena wouldn't eat a thing from this kitchen. Not after the time Denny said he saw one of the kitchen tools mess with her burger. He wouldn't say who it was or what they did, no matter how much he yelled and threatened him. And not knowing, of course, made it so much worse. She'd never done much herself, beyond the 10-second drop-it rule, and just once spitting in a drink, which the asshole deserved. She'd seen plenty, though. A girl she'd worked with at 4th Street used to slip Visine in drinks if the tips weren't good enough. A drop or two of Visine and you'd be in the bathroom all night. Even worse, one time at Chuck's Pizza, a shift manager had been so angry at a customer that he'd done something to her order that required a full 10 minutes in the other room. But still, even if you overlook that kind of thing, restaurant line cooks were the dirtiest fuckers on the planet, always reaching into their mouths, picking their teeth, scratching. Take Beau Tamowitz. Just looking at him was a good diet. And what killed Lena was that the others didn't care. All of them ordered food, ate it without a second thought. More than once, Lena had even caught Colleen eating leftovers off a customer's plate. Colleen, who made such a big stink about germs and freaked out if the milk was out of the refrigerator for more than 2 seconds. That's how Colleen was. She'd have all these goddamn rules, and then for no logical reason at all, would just break them. Lena shook the basket in the bubbling oil. The appetizers were done when they floated, but she liked them extra crispy. "Did I ever tell you," she asked Colleen, "about the dead cow I found?" "No." "When I was a kid with my dog, we found this cow." She shook the basket a few more times, then lifted it out of the oil and dumped the poppers and fingers onto a plate. "Is this going to make me not want to eat?" "No," Lena lied. There were some things she enjoyed telling Colleen. She couldn't help it. "I'm talking barely a cow, mostly bones, a little skin, dried blood, maybe some guts, kind of shriveling into long, stringy..." "Lena!" "But that wasn't even the worst." She paused. "You wouldn't last a day in the country, Colleen." "I wouldn't," Colleen said. She stuck a popper in her mouth and chewed. "Go on." "So, 2 days later, I hear my mom talking to one of the neighbors and find out that when the cow died..." "Do you want to hear this?" "Yes." "The cow is giving birth and something went wrong and the calf died and the mother went paralyzed. Just froze up with no one around to know. It could have been days, maybe weeks, just lying there, not being able to move. Can you imagine just lying there and staring out until buzzards came, parasites ate her, alive?" She lifted a chicken finger from the basket and dipped it in the barbecue sauce. Not a thing she could do but let it happen. "Lena, why do you tell me this stuff?" Lena shrugged, ate the finger. "By the way," she said, washing it down with Colleen's beer, "I'm ending it with Denny." "The thing with Denny," Colleen said, she could never just let something be, "is I always think there's more going on than it seems, you know, under the surface." "Of course there is," Lena snapped. She dropped more poppers into the fryer, watched them bubble up. "It's not James." "Oh, God, that's a good thing. Can you imagine?" "Fran's an idiot," Lena said. "What do you think of the new girl?" she asked. "I like her." "She's an idiot, too. She has a crush on Denny." "She's just young, Lena." "No, Lily is young." Colleen got that moony look on her face she got whenever you mentioned her daughter. For some reason, that look drove Lena up the wall. "Lily is young," Colleen said. "And needs a talking to," Lena thought. "Someone ought to do something."
Terry Yellen, reading from After Hours at the Almost Home. I'm Kay Callison. When you wrote this novel, and then you obviously had to do a lot of revising afterwards, were you thinking in ensemble terms, like in a play, of having a cast of characters where you had some kind of a totality in mind with respect to the ensemble?
Yes, it did come to me in sort of this one shape, this one splash, where all of these players are sort of a part of the bigger whole. It was very much like these voices emerged and came together, and you know, their backstory, their current stories, all of these pieces coming together. Yes, so the answer would be yes, it was definitely an ensemble.
Is that how you think? Do you hear voices?
In that sense, I do. I do hear voices, and I feel as though these characters have, these people have existed, and I'm lucky enough to sort of uncover, to discover them. The process of writing feels very much to me like chipping away and seeing what's really there. And so as I'm writing dialogue and as I'm rewriting scenes, I am hearing these people, and I kind of work the dialogue so I hear it the way it was really spoken, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me that one way the novel hangs together is you have at least two main tensions going on. Everybody's reaction to the new girl showing up, and of all days, Super Bowl Sunday, and everybody's reaction to the bartender not showing up.
That's right. The new girl comes in and the older bartender takes off.
Were you conscious of that when you revised the novel?
No, and I'm a little embarrassed to say that I wasn't conscious of that, because it's, again, these little things, these moments or relationships that echo or mirror what's going on in a bigger way. I think for me, it just feels like it's working. And then later I realize, oh, right, that's actually working because it fits in with this. But I'm never thinking about how things fit in structurally. It really, again, is just, what are these people doing? What are they talking about? What are they missing? And how uncomfortable are they going to get in this situation?
How do you analyze Keith? Would you consider him actually, in fact, a career weight person, at least de facto, whether he thinks of himself that way or not?
I do think that Keith, despite his dreams and his interests, I think he is a career weight person. I'm not sure. He might surprise me. He might break out.
Well, he's the leader. He's the one they always have train the new people.
Right.
I mean, at least that's the impression you get.
Right. Much to Lena's chagrin, he did, and he also won that award. So he is good at it, and I think probably he feels a little awkward in other areas and somehow kind of like a stutterer who goes on stage, even though he's big and possibly not the kind of person you would expect to see around food, as JJ observes. I think that he feels very at home, and he has in some ways found a family here.
Is there any character in After Hours at the Almost Home that you identify with more than any of the others?
I really identify with all of these characters. I feel a special connection with Lily. I won't say that I was JJ, but I was that person, and I've certainly had my share of embarrassing moments as a result of it.
I have to say, I identified with JJ.
I still wince a little at certain things she says and does.
Do you like these characters, all of them? Do you like them, and do you distinguish between liking and loving?
I love all of these characters, but I do not like them all.
Which ones don't you like?
I don't like Denny. I don't like what Denny does. I don't like the choices that a lot of them make. I don't like that Keith doesn't save Lily, but that's sort of a minor note.
But what about Lena?
Oh, yeah, you gotta hate Lena. But it's sort of fun to hate Lena. I love to hate Lena. I love Lily a great deal. And then I like JJ. And I like all of them at times. I think that when they sort of shine through their bad decisions, there are moments that I like, that I like each of them a great deal.
Well, it seems to me in Lena, you have a wonderfully villainous person.
Yeah, Lena likes to have some adventure. And she likes to think of herself as someone who has adventure.
And as somebody who knows better than everybody else.
Oh, yes. That's right. Lena does. Lena knows that better than anybody. And she's a little frustrated that everybody isn't sort of following her course.
And she's just flat mean.
Yes, she is.
Let's say it.
She is. She is. Yeah, it sort of brings me back to both waiting tables, and there was always that person that I admired a little for being able to just be flat out mean. I mean, you have to kind of admire that. There's some honesty in there, but it's also a little like being back at the bus stop as a kid.
Mm-hmm. Well, she certainly enjoys that scene with Colleen in the kitchen.
Oh, right.
I mean, that's just pure malice.
Yeah, there's definitely some anger in Lena, and she's not afraid to sharpen it and let it out.
You say you wrote this novel in a flash over a weekend, but then, of course, you had to revise it, you say. Can we talk about the revision process? What did you start with, and what were some of the big things you had to deal with in terms of making it come together in a graceful and organic whole, which it is, by the way?
Well, thank you. Well, after that weekend, I had a big mess in front of me, is what I had. Over the course of that weekend, I had taken notes on any kind of paper I could find, receipts and the backs of other manuscripts. I was writing madly, and I don't even think I could read half of what I had written down. But over a period of years, each of these characters, I just kind of developed each of these voices, and the way they fit together kind of happened on its own. At one point, I had to kind of color code. I had a chart of everything that happened in every chapter with the different characters. It did get to be a bit of a mess. But in the end, it kind of cleaned itself up. It all fell into place, and I'm making it sound simpler. There was it was hard. It finally did fall into place.
Well, one thing I was amazed by was the skill at which you keep several storylines moving at the same time. And sort of like the way a restaurant works, that at the same time, everybody's doing something different, but it's all got to come together to get the food on the table and the drinks there in a restaurant.
You know, now that you mention it, felt a lot like that. Maybe that's why I started having so many flashbacks of waiting tables at night.
What are some of the larger things that are going on here that you think anybody can identify with, whether they've worked in a restaurant or not?
I think feeling trapped, feeling stuck, feeling a part of a community but not a part of a community. One of the reasons that I love to read is to kind of enter other worlds and still at the same time feel anchored. And I hope that happens here, where even if you have not worked in a restaurant, you can kind of come in, feel like you have, feel a part of that, and get a sense of what that feels like. And then also feel some things that you would in other locations, but maybe it's heightened here.
If somebody were to ask you what you think this novel is about, what would you tell them?
I think it's about place and boundaries and feeling stuck and the struggle that we all kind of have to find our own way out of wherever we might be stuck.
Well, listen, thanks for taking time to talk with us today about After Hours at the Almost Home.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Tara Yellen, and I'm Kay Callison. This series of podcasts is sponsored by Unbridled Books, who promise you that rarest of pleasures, a good read. Other writers we're talking with these days include Stephen Evans, Jack Fuller, and Elizabeth Payne Rosen. For more information about After Hours at the Almost Home, along with other titles from Unbridled Books, check out their website at unbridledbooks.com. You'll find all kinds of interesting stuff there, including a long list of literary links and book study guides for most of their titles. This program was produced by Kay Callison for Unbridled Books. For other interviews with authors of fine prose conducted by Kay Callison, also known as Kay Bonetti, go to the American Audio Prose Library website at americanaudioprose.org. The music is by Tom Andes from his solo piano CD, One Voice. You can find it on Amazon.com. For Unbridled Aloud, this is Kay Callison.